Good morning, good afternoon, everybody. This is the Foreign Press Association here, and we're going to be talking with Chip Lyons, who is the president of the Elizabeth Glaser Foundation, which helps fight HIV mostly on the continent of Africa. And Chip has a lot of stories on how he does this. Good morning, Chip.
Good morning.
So, Chip, thanks for being with us today. It's an honor and a pleasure. And I just want to start this conversation by asking you, can you just tell us a little bit about the history of how the Elizabeth Glaser Foundation just came about?
I'm happy to, and thank you for the invitation and your interest in this set of issues. We are named for Elizabeth, whose family went through just an awful experience. She became infected with the virus while giving birth to her their firstborn. Paul Michael Glaser was a notable public figure at the time, an actor, very popular television program at the time in the 80s. She Elizabeth hemorrhaged. She was transfused. This is in Los Angeles. This is in the mid 80s, and the blood supply contained the virus. So it was early days in terms of the epidemic and the kind of safeguards and standard practices we have now were not in place at that time. Their second child was born, was infected in utero, and the children fell sick. And one thing led to another. They were tested, and all three of them, Elizabeth, and the two children were infected. Paul was not. That really launched. There was no name, there was no foundation at that point, but that launched Elizabeth onto a fight and onto a pathway that is best characterized as what happens if a mother is trying to save her children. And she discovered there was no research, there was no assumption or presumption or experience of children having the virus at the time. It was limited or known, thought to be limited to other age cohorts and so on. And that's where the foundation she created, Ari, the first, her daughter passed from AIDS. And Elizabeth's response to that was to rise up and do everything she could to prevent other families from suffering the kind of tragedy that they did. There was no research around pediatric HIV. There was certainly no medication. There wasn't medication at the time broadly, but they weren't even looking at the pediatric dimension of HIV and AIDS. She did remarkable things from advocating and pressing the White House. She was a keynote speaker, one of the keynote speakers at the Democratic National Convention in 91, I believe it was, in New York City. Ultimately, though, Elizabeth passed. Heroic efforts were made to try and save her, even giving her non-approved medications that were still experimental and under review. She passed in 1994 at the age of 47. Just imagine that, age 47 with two small children. And at that point, it became the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. And since then, we have continued the focus on pediatrics and young people. We've evolved tremendously. Just this last fall, we marked 35 years as an operational foundation. We're not an endowed foundation. Everything we do is the result of donors that believe in the mission, believe in leadership and protection for children, and we carry on. Yeah, in more ways than you might imagine, keeping in mind the spirit of Elizabeth.
Thank you so much for the background story of this amazing organization. So you work a lot with African children, African families. I was also curious about how do you handle conflict zones in Africa and still manage to do your work or displacement of communities?
Well, let me take a step back and put it in context. For the first number of years of the foundation, we were really focused on the United States. Science, many of the biggest heroes in the response to HIV and AIDS have been the scientists who, including very recently in the last couple of years, keep improving the tools that are available to prevent, to test for, and to treat HIV and AIDS. So back then, there weren't those tools. When a drug, nevirapine, was identified, for example, that dramatically reduced the chance of what's called vertical transmission, an HIV positive expectant mother giving birth on treatment at that time with nevirapine. It reduced the chance, the likelihood of transferring the virus to the newborn from anywhere from 30 to 40% down to 5 and even 2%. Once that got identified and approved and put into the medical and health delivery systems within the United States, the drop in the United States was 95% in new pediatric infections. It was just a stunning response. But it is also testimony to the wisdom of Elizabeth's reaction, which is kids are not on the agenda around HIV and AIDS. And so when they were, and this drug and a focus on mother-to-child transmission really got into high gear, that kind of dramatic response. At that point, the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, is a job done because it was successful in the United States? No, the job is not done. The issue is about HIV in children, and it still is prevalent and murderous in other parts of the world. The areas of the world you've already commented on, Africa, with the highest burdens are in sub-Saharan Africa, and they continue to be 90 plus percent of the children still affected, infected, affected by HIV and AIDS or at risk of are in sub-Saharan Africa. We work very directly. We advise in a broad number of countries, 18, 19 countries. We have a real physical presence. 90% of our staff are African nationals in the organization. That's 97 of almost 3,000 colleagues, medical doctors, researchers, public health specialists, system specialists, clinicians, et cetera. The countries where we work, I'm just doing a quick mental, you're picturing conflicts in certain zones. That's not the majority, circumstance. We work from South Africa to Lesotho and Eswatini, Mozambique, Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, Cameroon, DRC, Kenya, Tanzania, and so on. And they are not conflict zones. They are stable, developing, prospering, very capable societies and healthcare systems. Every healthcare system, any place I've ever been, including my own state, can get better. And that's the case in the countries that I identified. But conflict is not, that's kind of a notion of certain number of countries. Conflict is not on my list of things that we have to manage. There are many other things on that list. I want to say one more thing, which is what we have to recognize is the tremendous progress that has been made. I mean, we went from no response to HIV and AIDS, where the best thing an attending physician could do is hold a dying patient's hand, to having now optimized formulations, optimal medications, going from 10 or 12 pills a day to one pill a day, going from you only get a 1 month supply to a 6 month supply of your formulations, seeing new infections drop, seeing mortality drop, broadly speaking, being on a path towards controlling the epidemic. And that's measured, you know, with numbers about 95% of a society knows their status, meaning they've been tested, they have test results. 95% of the country knows their status. 95% of those are on treatment. It's one thing to know your status. It's another thing to be a part of a clinic and have a regular supply of medication. And the third 95, so we refer to it as 95, 95, 95. The third 95 represents 95% of people are virally suppressed, meaning they're on good solid medications. They're adherent, meaning they take them every day. And their viral load drops dramatically such that they aren't infectious anymore. Their own health is strong and they have bright prospects to go about and have the best lives they can have for themselves. So the story of HIV and AIDS today is it sometimes it can be a little complicated because tremendous progress. And yet, remember, there's no cure and there's no vaccine. So questions of sustaining that programmatic response, driving up those numbers, getting more, helping, supporting countries to begin to approach the 95, 95, 95 marker, the definition of epidemic control and sustaining it. That's our set of challenges today.
Yes, actually, on Tuesday night, I went to the Village Vanguard in Manhattan. And I went to hear a pianist called Fred Hirsch, who has been living with the virus for a while, and he wrote a book about it, his autobiography, and it's incredibly moving. It's a very interesting story, and he's one of the leading pianists in jazz today, you know, living with that virus and living okay, you know, his concert was wonderful. So I'm just saying it was really beautiful to be able to see him on stage perform some of the most beautiful jazz standards at one of the most important jazz venues in the world.
Yeah, I know the Vanguard and I know Mr. Hirsch as yes. a museum. It's a good example of let's not get lost in the statistics, in the large numbers that we can easily, and I'm happy to talk about them, but it's about individual lives. And so that's his example that you saw. When I'm in a community and I see dozens of kids, and I, you know, this might sound a little quaint or sweet or something, somewhere in there, that little girl could be the first president of that country or a doctor or a business person or a teacher or something. I mean, I know so many people who are living with the virus. They're in their 30s doing just remarkable work. They have their own HIV negative children because vertical transmission can be stopped. It's just brilliant. Children are, each one of them are born with this tremendous potential. And to let a preventable, treatable disease take them in the numbers that it still does is, sometimes I'm at a loss for words. It's unconscionable. Of course, it's unacceptable, but it's just so outrageous and short-sighted that we, the world, individual countries and communities should be investing everything they can in the care, the well-being, the prospering of their children. What could be a more compelling case? And that doesn't always happen. Children are not always on the political agenda, which I'm happy to talk about, but it's in a way, following Elizabeth's example, that's our purpose. I mean, I wake up every day thinking about how children can be more firmly a part of the political priority that has to be reinvigorated around HIV and AIDS globally.
Thank you. And before we started the webinar today, we were just talking about the importance of President Bush's support in this fight as well. And you told me that without Bush, there would not be any fight against HIV. Perhaps you want to discuss that a little bit.
Well, I had said I'm not sure we'd be having this conversation without President Bush. I find it hard to talk about him without using the most sort of dramatic language. What he did was historic. It is, and you know, folks might think this is hyperbolic, but it's not. The act of creating PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, is transformational globally, but particularly where the highest burdens were in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's not my personal American outsider point of view. That is the view oft expressed by African leaders, whether they're at the community level, whether they're educators or doctors or what have you. It was transformational. You and the listeners might not recall at the peak of, well, I don't know if it was the peak, but when it was still just flaming pandemic, there were questions about whether some societies were going to survive because the most productive age cohort of those, the teachers, the doctors, the nurses, the engineers, were dying in huge numbers, being left with teenagers and young children and older adults and grandparents. I mean, that's how severe it was until the ability and to treat, to test better, and to provide treatment really kicked in. Again, the science and the private sector, pharma and manufacturers of testing technology and so on. Those things, maybe they would have happened eventually, but that's the counterfactual, and there's no point in dwelling on that. They happened because President Bush launched PEPFAR. I mean, I don't know how many African countries I've been in, and in a taxi going somewhere, I'm on George W. Bush Boulevard or George W. Bush Avenue. He is regarded in heroic terms in sub-Saharan Africa, and he launched a capability to respond to what was the world's most severe pandemic. It's far larger than COVID. I mean, we all know what COVID's done to us, but just for listeners to recall who may not remember some of the scope of this, there were 85 million people who were infected with the virus. There were 40 million people who died because of the virus. On the other side, there are nearly 30 million people who are on treatment. The number of lives saved, 20 north of 20 million lives saved. Around the world, you can draw a direct line from the progress we've made back to a State of the Union address where President Bush announced the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief.
Just for our listeners who may not be familiar with PEPFAR, can you just remind us what PEPFAR exactly stands for?
Sure. The President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, that's the acronym, but more importantly than the word, and it was a different approach at the time, what was characterized as an all of government approach. So there is an Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator, there is a head of PEPFAR. Ambassador Dr. John Nkengasong is the head of PEPFAR today and has been for 18 months or so. When I say all of government, it means it draws on the best of USAID, the Agency for International Development. It draws on the US Centers for Disease Control. It includes the Department of Defense because the uniformed services in different countries similarly were affected by infections of HIV and AIDS and have their own distinctive way of responding to them, which we help them with in terms of technical assistance and so on. The Peace Corps is a part of that consortium, Health and Human Services, the department. So multiple all of government that would have, and the State Department of Defense is a part of that. That's what PEPFAR is, in the aggregate. And then there are very substantial funding that, let's not forget the role of Congress. Presidents can propose, Congress needs to authorize and appropriate, and they did. They took very bold Barbara Lee and other members of Congress at that time deserve as much credit, because the other half of the coin, literally and figuratively, is how is Congress going to respond to the State of the Union address? And they respond with courage, with generosity, motivated a little bit by fear, just what was happening to families and communities in such large numbers. That's how it all came together and has progressed since then as a partnership between the U.S. government, ministries of health, and governments in countries where PEPFAR continues to work, and then partners with the technical and implementation capability like the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation.
Thank you. Earlier today, you know, when maybe a few minutes ago, you told me that conflict zones were not one of your challenges. And you said to me that you have a lot of other challenges or perhaps things you really need to pay attention to. Can you mention some of this?
I absolutely can. Let me repeat the point that I made, that thanks to the research and the work of scientists and drug development leaders and so on, we have optimized tools, particularly for testing and treatment, and they now include kids. One of the challenges, constant challenges that we face, is children are not considered an explicit political priority in terms of the response. That seems counterintuitive. Who wouldn't? Who's against children? Short answer is nobody's against children. But when budgets are tight or in the process of determining policy priorities, older age cohorts are louder, more powerful, more influential, have more, they're at the table or they're in the streets. So much of the improvement in the HIV and AIDS situation is due to activists, civil society organizations, and others demanding access to improved medications or what have you. And there's an incredibly rich history. I wonder how many HIV protests went past the Village Vanguard where you are down in the village, but there would have been a lot. I can assure you of that. So one of our key challenges is having children explicitly on the agenda. I can say more about that, which means there's policies for children. There is funding commensurate with those policies. Political leaders, society leaders speak out for children to make sure they're included instead of left behind, because very often they're left behind. That's a sort of meta challenge. Stigma is a huge challenge. There are communities that are discriminated against. There are, you know, why did you get the virus? What did you do to get the virus? Well, tell that to a, you know, 3-year-old, for goodness sakes. So stigma is a big challenge. In some communities, folks think HIV, you know, this is now a 40-year, 35, 40-year phenomenon. There's a weariness about having to continue the battle. I understand that. COVID, I don't think this is the case. We're not done with COVID. We're still seeing infections in the United States and in other places. But that's after 4 years. Folks are tired of the masks. They're tired of this. They're not signing up for another round of booster shots. They're just tired of it. That's after 4 years. Imagine after 40 years. So in the absence, and, you know, we do have very strong treatment around COVID, and we have Paxlovid, you know, to help, et cetera. There still is no cure nor a vaccine for HIV and AIDS. And that's a problem if political priority shifts onto other, you know, pressing things. Because if you stop providing services, if people stop getting tested, you're not continuing to put more people on treatment, you create a kind of service void. Where that void exists, the HIV virus will reassert itself. So you can't just hope this goes away. You've got to sustain the fight. And that's hard to do over decades. That's a substantial political policy and funding challenge when there are so many competing issues. And then, there's issues really down on the ground. If only about half of what we believe are HIV-infected children are on treatment, where's the other half? What else do we need to do to identify those kids, get them tested, get them on treatment so that they are virally suppressed? So innovation, doing things differently, the things that got us to where we are today with the tremendous progress towards epidemic control are not all the same things that are going to make help make decisive kind of progress in the next several years, because the international community, through UN high level meeting and so on, and a part of the Sustainable Development Goals around health includes HIV and AIDS, and that goal signed on to all by go all governments was to end HIV and AIDS as a public health crisis by 2030. Many countries are on track to do that. A number of countries are not. And it's not enough to cross a line in 2030 and say, we did it, we're clear, because lack of vigilance creates opportunity for a reassertion and reinsertion of HIV into communities and countries and so on.
So if you had the power to let's say, like, if there was one person you could speak to right now to help the foundation, who would that person be? Someone that you think could really impact your fight or help. Who would you want to speak with and maybe try to convince that person of?
That's a great question. I'm going to rephrase it a little bit, because it wouldn't be a person, or I'm going to answer it in two ways. The reason I said rephrase it is it isn't primarily about the foundation. It's about where kids are in the response. But who can help the foundation? Let me take that first. Where anyone is particularly inspired by this mission and wants us to help us and our partners, those we work with, ministries of health, communities, and so on, support our work. I mentioned earlier we're an operational foundation. What I mean by that is we're not endowed. We have to sing for our supper. Every piece of work we do, or folks hope that we do, is the result of philanthropic. Excuse me, private sector, US government funding and investment in the pediatric HIV and AIDS agenda. So, a particularly ambitious and excited philanthropist would be someone I would want to talk to, because they could do a world of good. More broadly, the single most important, and it's not just one person, there's several people. I would put in a category of African presidents. President Ruto in Kenya in December committed Kenya to ending HIV and AIDS as an epidemic by the end of 2027 in Kenya. That's exactly the kind of voice and political leadership, followed up by that being a directive to a minister of health and a minister of finance. The ministries of health, can't do their work on vapors, right? It needs to be a partnership in government where it's one of the major markers and commitments of a government to end and sustain the epidemic in their country. President Ruto did that in December, and I think there will be opportunities in the next couple of months for more presidents, hopefully to follow that lead or to characterize their response in their own country in the way that it makes most sense for them. That could be in the context of a commitment to a policy of universal health care, for example, which the World Health Organization advocates and has a lot of expertise on. Similarly, so it isn't just one person, but the categories are leaders of those agencies and organizations that are a part of the fight against HIV and AIDS. So, the head of the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and malaria. There's more I know they want to do, as they have expressed themselves around the pediatric agenda. the head of PEPFAR has already been very clear in the new strategy about a priority for pediatric around kids. Other governments and donors, I mean, EGPAF, you know, we're pretty clear. People rely on us to do a certain number of things, including being a voice for children and a fighter, including a political advocate for children. The task is a very large one. It by no means is that left to one organization. There are other, so many other partner organizations on the continent of Africa, in Europe, and elsewhere. But those are the folks that have to continue to say 2030 is what, 6 short years away. We have an enormous amount of work to do. We need more resources. We need more, encourage more African leadership and voice to come forward on it. There's work being done on that. The First Lady of Namibia, Monica Gengos, is a remarkable leader and voice on this issue. And there are many, many others, social media influencers, religious leaders. The Vatican is supportive of advancing this work. It takes that sort of grand alliance for children to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish.
Thank you. And I don't know if we have time for this other question I have, but I just wanted to, I was curious about, when did you decide to start this fight yourself? You know, what happened? When
to
was
start it?
Yes. When was the key moment when you decided, this is what I'm going to do?
Well, I just marked my 14th year here at the foundation. And as you can tell, I'm not 24 years old. So I've been working in this area of child survival and well-being for 40 years. And the single most influential person for me is someone called Jim Grant. He was the executive director of UNICEF from 1981 to 1995 through 1994. And I saw his strategic, political, programmatic brilliance, where UNICEF was a preeminent leader in the world around child survival and development issues. I saw what could be done. I worked for UNICEF for over 20 years. It's just stunning. I still last week saw a reference to a Christmas column in the New York Times by Nick Kristof that makes reference to the dramatic fall in infant mortality and morbidity. Well, the seeds of that is from the 80s and the 90s. In fact, he usually cites UNICEF and Jim Grant as that's just infectious in the positive sense of what a person, what an agency, what an organization can do. Fast forward 14 years ago, I was working at another place, a well-known foundation in Seattle, and I was asked to consider coming to EGPAF. And I was so impressed with their technical record that I felt we could politically and through communications and advocacy and continued program delivery and research and so on, we could try and turn EGPAF's mission, Elizabeth's mission, into the international community's mission. That's kind of the task, because it does take everyone. It can't just be EGPAF. But that's what we try and do. And you know, we have our moments. We're pretty good at what we do, but the task is enormous. The challenges and priorities for whether they're African presidents, whether they're European philanthropists and others, there's no shortage of issues for them to try and address. But we're gonna, you can be sure we're gonna continue to put forward the notion we can end this epidemic in a sustainable way, and it can include children, not leave them behind in that eventual progress and success.
Thank you, Chip. And do you have one anecdote you would like to share with us, you know, along the years you've been with the foundation? Like, can you tell me about one moment where you were particularly thrilled with your work, or touched, or you witnessed maybe a success in this fight?
Oh, I'm blessed to have so many of them. I'll do a positive and a frustrating one. A very distinguished HIV researcher was going to be on a panel. I was going to be on the panel. And we were reviewing our slides and so on. And the organizer said, "Oh, professor, sorry, it's too long. You have to shorten it." His response is, "Well, I'll just take the piece about kids out." And I said, "No, you can't." And that just illustrates what happens too often. The budget's tight, you take a piece out. The you don't have enough time, I won't talk about the kids. You don't have these policies, well, we don't have time. That's why there is the need for an EGPAF and all of our partners and others that speak to these issues, because kids get left behind. On the positive side, just seeing a mom who gets the test results, she's HIV positive herself, she's on treatment, and she gets the test results that her now 1 day old, 2 day old infant is HIV negative.
I see. Yes, thank you. I think what you're talking about is silenced voices and communities. When you talk about children who are not being considered as a political voice altogether, I think you're talking about silenced voices. Is that correct?
Well, and just the nature of it. Right. I mean, kids don't organize demonstrations. Kids don't shout. They're taught to behave. They're taught to listen to their elders. Understandably, I told my kids most of those same things. They didn't always listen to their elders, but they made their own good decisions. They're not in the streets. They're not, or methodically organizing political pressure to change budgets or to force their way onto agenda. It's an unequal fight, it's like world-class, politically organized, capable, exceptional mobilization versus the kids. And so your comment is accurate in that the result of that is a kind of silencing. It's not intended to silence them. As I said earlier on, I've never met anyone that was against kids. I've met a lot of people and had a lot of discussions with people who want to do more and don't see how to do it. Finite resources, finite policy space, an absence of political leaders. But I just kind of say the word children. If you're president, if you're foreign minister, you're minister of health, talk about children. Ask questions. Are children in our plan? Are children on our agenda? Are children in the budget so that the kinds of things that we're capable of doing are going to get done? Children need others, including with political and budgetary and policy influence power, to speak for children.
Thank you so much. I think for the time being, I'm fine with my questions. But if there is something you would like to mention that I didn't ask you about, feel free.
I thought you might have asked me about what's roiling not just Washington, D.C., but it has implications in other countries where PEPFAR, which is the reauthorization of PEPFAR, that is stalled. It should have been, it has been reauthorized 3 times each for 5 years each, because PEPFAR was created 20 some years ago. It's stalled presently. That's a worry that's been expressed to me by a number of African leaders. It's a worry for us too. EGPAF has a very strong policy and advocacy role to that we do play. I already had three conversations this morning about reauthorization. That requires getting into kind of the nuts and bolts of policy and budgeting in the United States, which I completely understand most people don't have a strong interest in that. At the end of the day, the US system is such that a program gets authorized first and then it gets funding for it appropriated. Activities can continue while the reauthorization debate continues, but I just want to note that the reauthorization work continues, but so does PEPFAR. PEPFAR didn't stop because it wasn't reauthorized on September 30th. But it's very important, as Senator Graham said, PEPFAR is the most pro-life program he's ever been a part of. PEPFAR is life-saving. PEPFAR is community and country stabilizing. PEPFAR is about equity, health equity for people. It's about giving children the opportunity to live full and complete lives. It needs to be reauthorized, a full and clean reauthorization for the next 5 years. At the same time, with plans for transition of more and more of this work to go to host governments so that they invest more of their own resources in the response to their own epidemic, HIV and AIDS epidemic in their country.
So, to me, from what you are sharing with us, it does sound like there was a major shift as far as support for HIV infected communities between the Bush presidency and subsequent presidencies.
No, in fact, I would say that President Obama and I would also say President Trump, they basically kept PEPFAR at the same level. And the issue around reauthorization isn't about the administration. I think it would be useful if the Biden administration were really vocal and clear that reauthorizing PEPFAR is a legislative priority for them. I think that's very important. Where it's got hung up is a very specific issue with a couple of members of Congress who unfortunately have been encouraged to believe that the PEPFAR somehow has been changed. And is a strong stealth or explicit proponent of abortion. That's not true. I'm the CEO of an organization. The last thing in the world I or any of our colleagues would do is to use US government funding for something that PEPFAR is not a part of the PEPFAR program. You don't play around with things like that. You make sure you're squeaky clean. You're following very closely what the parameters are in terms of funding that's made available by CDC or USAID or the Department of Defense. So, unfortunately, a seed was planted, and in the political environment we're in 2024, the question of abortion divides a lot of people. And it, at times, it almost feels like it's a fact-free zone. Things are stated that are not corroborated, where there's no evidence of that. In fact, there's no practice of it. But things are a little that poses a substantial challenge as well.
Thank you so much, Chip. I just wanted to give some time for potential questions from our listeners. And I'm happy to answer these questions if there are any. Let me just check. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions at the moment. But if anybody has one, we are ready for them. And maybe Chip, while I'm waiting or looking at the chat box, would you like to perhaps say something to journalists all over the world covering all kinds of topics, including especially health topics? Would you like to maybe say something to them since we are trying to be the voice of international reporters?
Yeah. That's a good question. I would put journalists into the same category. Whether you're interviewing political leaders or aspiring political leaders, I ask them if they have an agenda for children in their country or in their party or what have you. What are the elements of that? Do you see yourself as a leader that's speaking as well for children? And if they, I would imagine often the answer to that would be, of course, tell us about it. How did, what are the policies you would advance that would lead to an improved set of circumstances for kids? How do those policies get executed? How does your budget reflect a commitment to children? People don't have to have all their own ideas formulated about it. Ask the question. Ask about children. See what people have to say. And in some cases, they might just quickly say, "Oh my goodness, we really haven't developed, really formulated a plan, whether it's education, whether it's nutrition, whether it's around HIV, or in other areas." Posing the question so that leaders of different kinds should anticipate they're going to be asked about that and develop their own ideas and be reminded that while no one's against children, they are so regularly left behind. Kind of an assumption. I had one back to your anecdote question. I was in a conversation with the head of global health in a major pharmaceutical company. And when we were talking and I was characterizing where we are in pediatric AIDS, he kind of took off his glasses. He said, "God, I just assumed that children would be taken care of." And I thought, how could you assume that? I mean, we do that as parents. We do that as members of a school or parents of a school and PTAs and so on. We find expression in different ways for our concern about kids, but it doesn't often or always, anyway, translate into major national or state, in the case of the United States, or provincial or county priority to kids. And so folks need to be asked about that. There's room always to do more for kids. So push a little bit with respectful questions.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is a conversation that maybe is not being it is not happening a lot. And I just saw one question in the chat box. But I think you may have answered it already. It's do you have any complaints about reporters or how they actually handle that topic? But I think your main complaint is the absence of the question.
Yeah, I'm not in the business of complaining about journalists.
Maybe you should.
That might be a dead end road, but seriously, I've been a communications officer during a time of war in Mozambique when I worked there in the late '80s. Thank goodness for the BBC at that time. Thank goodness for so many other journalists, and thank goodness part of their line of thinking is, what are the effects on these circumstances? This is in Mozambique and South Africa, still during the apartheid. What's happening to kids? And you can go into the record and see there's some remarkable reporting as well as remarkable research that sought to answer that question. I think the more journalists that say, at least part of my line of interest and inquiry, includes the circumstances for kids wherever they are. I'm not just talking about HIV and AIDS, and I'm not just talking about Africa. Just make that a topic that folks are given the opportunity to speak to it.
Thank you, Chip. I think we are at the end of our conversation. So I'm very happy you were able to make time for this webinar today. And I look forward to having more conversations in the future. And thank you so much for your important insights into this fight and into the future of children.
I really enjoyed talking with you, Emily, and I'd be happy to do so again when you're moved to do that. So thank you for creating the opportunity in your own way. You might not have thought about it, this way when it first came to you, but this is a good example where you decided to ask a bunch of questions about kids and HIV. That's very helpful.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Bye bye.
Bye.